Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The industries of artificial intelligence and automation have made great strides in recent years. Between them, many jobs will be achieved by the flip of a switch or the issue of a command. That means humans have to find different occupations. What are we supposed to tell our children? New York Times reporter and father Alex Williams recently wrote about this challenge. He joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show.
Hey, great to be here.
You wrote that countless professions could be made obsolete by the time your two young boys reach their 20s. We've all heard about self-driving cars and trucks and that sort of thing. What are some of the jobs that are less obvious that you're talking about?
Well, I mean, I think we've all gotten used to the idea that auto workers and that sort of thing, you know, there's a lot of automation in factories and that sort of thing. But really, the AI right now is coming after the white-collar jobs. I mean, certainly, you're already seeing inroads in medicine. I mean, there are sophisticated software programs that are able to do scans that radiologists take 45 minutes to accomplish in seconds. I mean, there are all sorts of document review software programs that are, you know, freeing up, you know, between 20% and 60% of the time that some lawyers and law firms spend on document review. Even on Wall Street, I think you see more and more software that can do sophisticated modeling of financial projections and actually decide where to invest, that sort of thing. And again, I mean, I think we're just at the beginning of this. Who knows where it goes in 10 years?
What are some of the jobs that might be at risk sooner rather than later?
I mean, that's a really good question. I would say that you talk to the experts in this field, and they say that most jobs, the jobs that are most at risk are those that take place in sort of a static environment, you know, say at a desk in front of a computer, mm-hmm. doing the same thing over and over. Even if it's, you know, that doesn't have to mean work, you know, building widgets on a factory floor. Even, you know, a lot of white-collar jobs involve sort of doing the same kind of quantitative analyses over and over and over. You know, you get this data, you have to plug it into this model, and you have to figure out kind of how to allocate resources. All that stuff is pretty, you know, pretty automatable. You can, you know, the computers are really good at looking at past performance, at all the data projections, and they're pretty good at sort of coming up with probabilities about, okay, we should put resources here, here, or here. So, I mean, a lot of that kind of, you know, that quantitative analysis, I mean, you know, you think of a job like a certified financial planner, mm-hmm. You know, as recently as the 1990s, everybody, you know, a lot of people had financial planners to figure out, okay, well, what's your age? What's your risk aversion? That sort of thing. Okay, well, we can give you these models, you know, this allocation of stocks and bonds. But right now, I mean, anybody that uses a service like Fidelity already has bots doing it for them anyway, or, you know, Vanguard. You plug in your age, you talk about your risk tolerance, and the computer does the rest. And I think that's, we're going to start seeing far more sophisticated versions of that. I mean, you could even go to, you know, hedge funds and some of the, you know, the very high value added kind of jobs.
We're talking about what jobs will go away because of automation and artificial intelligence. My guest is Alex Williams. He's a reporter for the New York Times. He wrote about this recently. We'll have a link to his article on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. You know, I had just heard about, you know, the how lawyers kind of cut their teeth on studying documents and reading them and looking for the glitches, and that computer programs can do this now pretty easily. There's so much boilerplate out there. But I'm wondering what it means for the profession writ larger if they're not kind of learning that at the knees of, you know, the document review. Then where are they going to come from in the future? How are they going to move up the food chain?
No, that's a really good question. I mean, it's funny because a friend of mine, actually, he's an ex-lawyer, like a lot of lawyers mm-hmm. these days, but he went to Stanford Law School. He was working at a top firm in San Francisco. And even he said the job, you know, even at that high level, at least, you know, in his first years, was kind of like reading your car warranty for 12 hours a day. And honestly, you know, sometimes you might need a computer just to be able to stay awake during that. But it's a valid question. I mean, when you talk to the employment experts and the people that have written about this topic, they seem to place a lot of faith in the idea that there's still areas where, you know, the sort of human intuition, sort of the human ability to make interesting connections between discrete sort of areas, you know, the real high value added stuff, the stuff that, you know, personality based, obviously, you know, being a litigator is something mm-hmm. that could still happen. You know, making the sophisticated decisions is at present still something that I think is pretty secure. But down the road, it's hard to say. I mean, you know, a good example that I saw was there was a TED talk that I was watching recently, and he made the point that, for instance, let's go back to the invention of the microwave oven.
Mm-hmm.
That all happened back during World War II. This guy named Perry Spencer was working for Raytheon, the defense contractor, and he was working on microwave radar transmitters. And he kept noticing that the candy bars in his pocket were melting. He put two and two together and said, "Hey, I don't care about the radio transmitters. I can make a microwave oven." And you know, that's the kind of thing that, you know, computers aren't going to have that vision to imagine a product that's never been imagined. You know, there's not going to be a robo Steve Jobs. You know, computers probably aren't going to be entrepreneurs. They're not going to come up with a whole. They're not going to see, you know, envision an entire industry and create a product to fill that that need. But a lot of things, like I said, I mean, even, you know, middle management's a really good question. I was actually talking to an MIT professor named Andrew McAfee for the story, and he was saying that he thinks middle managers are going to be just fine in the near term, because for any organization that still has people involved, you really need somebody who can, you know, be a motivator, a coach, sort of basically it's that kind of like that very human touch sort of thing. But, you know, that begs a couple of questions. A, how many humans will be in the workplace of the future?
Mm-hmm.
And B, do you really need it? I mean, it was just, ironically enough, there was a story in the Wall Street Journal yesterday, the same day that my story hit, and it was talking about AI coming to middle management. And there's actually a really interesting quote from a professor in there, and he was saying that basically that the quote was, "What managers do mostly is identify potential, build teams, assign tasks, measure performance, and provide feedback. Generally speaking, humans aren't very good at these tasks." So it's an open question. You know, do middle managers have a future? I'm not sure.
There has been a push for STEM education and for more computer science in the classroom. We just did a show about it last week where they're looking at switching out requirements, computer science for math and science. It's maybe in some states, I think Georgia, for foreign language. But is that necessarily where parents should be focusing their kids?
You know, that's a really good question. And I mean, I came at this story from the point of view of a parent. I've got a 7- and a 4-year-old. I actually interviewed them for the story, and mm-hmm. they're responses were amusing. I mean, they were talking about all the things they wanted to be. And, you know, my son, Toby, who's 7, said he either wanted to be an actor or an Uber driver. I made the joke in the piece that those are often the same thing. But seriously, you know, Uber drivers might not be around in 3 or 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
Uber just bought, I think, 24,000 Volvo SUVs to be, you know, part of a driverless fleet. And actors, who knows? I mean, you know, you had CGI characters in the most recent Star Wars movie.
Mm-hmm.
A few years ago for Fast and Furious 7, Paul Walker died during the filming, and so they did a virtual recreation of him for his final scenes. And, you know, what's the real step beyond just, you know, instead of, you know, do you even need that human actor to base things on? So, yeah, as far as what to focus on for parents, that's the million-dollar question. I don't think anybody has any real answers. I think that what most experts told me is that jobs certainly involving creativity, either creative thinking as sort of a, you know, an engineer maybe, or, you know, a researcher, certainly is somewhat robot proof. Obviously the more creative professions at present are, I mean, I don't think you're going to have like robotic poets or anything, but then not a big market for poets anyway. But, I think anything involving that human touch, I mean, my takeaway from this is that in the future, even if robots, I mean, the sort of the optimistic view here is that robots take away all the grunt work we don't want to do.
Well,
you know,
yeah, that's horrible, utopian.
You know,
yeah.
All that legal review that is actually boring, like reading your car warranty, and leave us all the cool stuff that takes, you know, intuition and thinking and stuff. And that could happen. I mean, there could be a rosy view here, but, and it is already happening. I mean, there's already, you know, there are so many services online that can do basic legal review, et cetera, et cetera, that will, you know, allow you to start a business for cheaper. And it's easier to be an entrepreneur now because of all this stuff. But, you know, I mean, I think that my take is that in the future, it's probably going to be, there's going to be a premium on, I mean, basically human interaction is going to be a luxury good in some ways. I mean, you know, right now there are restaurants in Tokyo that are completely robot, you know,
mm-hmm.
basically roboticized, you know, robot cooks, robot servers, et cetera, et cetera. and they're very popular. But I don't think that's going to take over, because I mean, I think that
that's sort of a gimmick, right?
It's a gimmick, and I mean, I think, for instance, you know, people have made the point that for fast food restaurants, why not? And sure, I mean, going to Burger King, why? You know, you don't really need the person there punching the keys. I think, you know, Burger King is probably not a great growth, opportunity for people. But you know, for a regular restaurant, I think people are going to really pay a premium because they want that human interaction, and I think it's going to be that way in a lot of industries. I mean, whether you're talking about, you know, life coaches, yoga teachers, massage therapists, psychotherapists, marriage counselors, any of that stuff. I mean, I think there's going to be, you know, it's humans are good at being human, and that's a good place to focus your energy.
It seems like that could also be a great divide when it comes to the classes. The income classes, the poor people will have to deal with machines, and the wealthy will have that human contact.
That is true, although the one interesting thing that came out of this, and a lot of people have noticed this, the experts have said that, you know, it's going to be, as somebody said in my article, you know, anybody who works with their hands for the time being is fine, because it's going to be a long, long time before there's a robotic plumber. And I think that's kind of true. I mean, I think that there are a lot of, you know, contractors, gardeners. I mean, there are plenty of, you know, blue collar, for lack of a better term, jobs that are probably extremely robot proof. I mean, you know, auto mechanic, it's going to be a long time before we see that. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think this has already had huge effects in, you know, the American economy. I mean, you look at the disappearance of industrial jobs, and some of that is obviously offshoring, you know, plenty of it is, but plenty of it is also automation. Those jobs just aren't around anymore. I mean, if you see a video of a GM factory floor from the early 60s, they're on YouTube, and then you look at one now, it's just shocking. It's absolutely shocking.
Well, so what are the buggy whips today? What do you think?
Buggy whips, well, I think, well, I mean, we've already seen plenty of buggy whips. I mean, look at what Kayak did to travel agents and that sort of thing. I mean, those people are... I mean, ironically enough, I still use a travel agent because I think it's great. You know, she doesn't charge me anything, and she's the one who goes to Kayak and gets my stuff for me. And so maybe, you know, maybe that job is not as obsolete as it seems. But yeah, certainly anything that involves looking at a bunch of data and coming up with the five best options is something a computer can do within seconds, and it might take a person all day. So, you know, that's, like I said, I think, you know, financial planners, some of those kind of, you know, claims adjusters, you know, the jobs like that are certainly at risk. I mean, the one that popped up in my mind was even baseball managers. I mean, you think about it, baseball managers used to be the ultimate, you know, it was all about your eye and your gut and kind of knowing like which pitcher's a gamer, who are you going to start? You know, is this guy gassed? When do you take him out? But that stuff is also data driven. I mean,
as we've learned from the great movie. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I was struck that the San Francisco Giants recently basically kicked their pitching coach, Dave Rigetti, upstairs, removed him because he was kind of an old school guy. He still kind of did it on instinct and gut and all that stuff. And they wanted somebody who could crunch numbers just like everybody else is crunching numbers. So, yeah, I mean, I think baseball managers, like, that stuff already should be computerized if it's not already. Basically is.
So what are you doing with your two boys?
I mean, I'm freaking out about it and trying to come up with a plan.
That anyways, trust me.
That is true. No, that's the nature of parenthood.
Right.
I mean, right now I'm still at the point where I'm trying to get them enthusiastic about learning. I mean, the point was made to me, the author Martin Ford, who wrote a very good book on this called Rise of the Robots, big bestseller a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. He was saying that, you know, it sounds like a cliche, but you really want to foster the love of learning, because if nothing else, they're probably going to be in an industry where, you know, one industry is going to change. And so they might have to jump to another And so the ability to think on the fly, to learn quickly and to enjoy learning is going to be a crucial skill. So I think more than any specific skill, because I can't tell you if, you know, computer science or, you know, aromatherapy are going to be like, you know, a better industry in the future. But I do know that somebody who's like intellectually nimble and is a quick learner and an enthusiastic learner that's a good place to start.
Alex Williams, thanks for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Of course. It's been great. Thank you.
Alex Williams, reporter for The New York Times, will post a link to his article about what are we supposed to tell our kids and how to find a job in the future of AI and automation on our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. More Tech Tuesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. If you use email to communicate every day, especially for work, maybe you sometimes wonder whether anybody out there is reading your correspondence. Turns out that getting that information is not difficult, that many emails are tracked, and that a sender can even determine when and where an email has been opened. Journalist Brian Merchant recently wrote about this for Wired. We'll post a link to his story, How Email Tracking Quietly Took Over the Web, at WOSU.org/AllSides. Welcome, Brian Merchant.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You know, every once in a while I get a message when I open an email asking if I want to let the sender know whether I've opened it or not. I figured that was the extent of this.
Well, it's a kind of a similar phenomenon. That's just like an additional courtesy that sender has given you, or that the service, that particular service that they're using has offered. That's called a read receipt, and they're really common. And actually, email tracking has evolved out of that same exact sort of technique. So what they're doing is pretty much the same thing that the email trackers are doing, and that's embedding a tiny little pixel that you would never see. It's invisible in the email message, and when your email client, whether it's Gmail or Outlook or whatever, opens that email, it also opens that image, and when that happens, it sends a little ping back to the server by which it was embedded, and from that little ping, the sender of the email with tracking or read receipts can tell exactly when, where, and how that email was opened.
How much does it cost to employ this service?
So it's free. There are dozens. I didn't do an extensive documentation of every single service that's out there, but there are too many to count.
Hmm.
They are both plugins to things like Gmail, where you can just kind of install it in less than a minute with a click. And then anybody, myself included, I used email trackers to sort of research and experiment for this article.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very, very, very easy to use. And that's kind of the surprising thing, is just how easy they are to install, how ubiquitous they've become, and how quietly this has happened. We may not know that, some of our friends and colleagues and even spouses or partners are using email tracking software to gather just an extra layer of information about how the people around them are opening their email. We kind of expect this stuff from the big tech companies, right? Facebook or Amazon, people that we're kind of used to trying to gather as much data about us as possible. And we might expect marketers, people who have an interest in trying to figure out how many people are opening their newsletters or their sales pitches. But it turns out more and more everyday people just who are curious about, how their partners, colleagues, friends are opening their email. One in five, according to the study that I cite in the article, are using this, what you might call everyday email tracking.
One of the other things is it goes an extra step and actually tells you whether they're opening it on their whatever device they're on, whether it's their phone or their tablet or their laptop or whatever.
Right. Yeah.
So, what do you need to know that for?
There's all sorts of different reasons. I mean, I don't need to know it. You probably don't need to know it. But a marketing company that's interested in how they optimize their email newsletter pitches, for example, if just 10% of people are opening it on a desktop and 90% are opening it on mobile, that tells them pretty clearly that they need to start, you know, catering their pitches or their newsletters to that particular service. But I mean, that's funny. I mean, the whole reason that I got mixed up into this whole email tracking world is because I was, I was writing a book about Apple, which is notoriously secretive and is not typically press friendly. So we had a couple nice conversations, but then they went dark. And I had heard from another journalist who employed this technique just to see, is anybody reading my emails over there, or am I just kind of sending them off into this void and nobody's even paying attention to anything? I'm wasting my time. So I installed Streak, which is one of the most popular email trackers. It's, again, it took me 30 seconds. It's incredible how easy this is to do. And then I emailed Apple's PR department, and sure enough, just almost instantly, you can just watch all the different people that are opening the email, forwarding it on, opening it, reading it, and you can say, okay, this is in Cupertino. This was opened on an iPhone. This one was on a Mac. This one was on, and it's just bouncing around. So you see, you gather this information that it becomes kind of useful professionally for people who are in fields that can use info like that, sales.
You mean you can even track it if it's been forwarded?
Oh, yeah. You track it every time. Every time it's opened, every time it's clicked on, even if it's the same person that keeps opening it, you see it every time. If they forward it to somebody else, you see it when they open it, because that pixel just gets forwarded along with it. And it again, it's a very, very simple technique and technology that's being used here. You can just watch it. So if you have notifications set up, I'm sitting there, you know, with my laptop open, and I email, let's say, Apple PR. And then, boom, a notification box pops up in the top right-hand corner of my screen. This was just opened here by this.
That's so weird. Can you tell if it's been deleted?
Unfortunately, you can't.
Okay.
The information that you get is sort of limited to that opening action. And again, one of the interesting things about this whole phenomenon is that it's old. It's been going on for about 10 years, and it's sort of evolved and become ubiquitous over that time. And I think one of the interesting things is that there hasn't been a kind of a freak-out moment, you know, when Ed Snowden revealed that, you know, that the phone companies were sending all this data to the NSA or something, where everybody's like, oh, wow, this is happening. So this is just kind of quietly crept up and grown, and it's the number of uses for it has expanded. The amount of data that they can gather just by sending you this has grown. The sort of the sophistication of the tracking elements has grown, but there hasn't been one sort of inflection point where we've said, wait a minute, do we want this as part of our day-to-day email life? If 40% of all emails, 40% of every single email you get is tracked, 40%. That's almost half at this point. The sender that is sending you that email is getting a lot of data about you, where you are, what device you're using, when you open your email.
Go ahead.
Oh, no. Yeah, it was just I think we have to make a decision as a society that still runs on email if we want to sort of accept this reality, even though it's just bubbling under the surface. We have to decide if that's a new layer we want to introduce to our email interaction.
As if we had a choice at this point.
Right.
But we're talking about email trackers today. You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Brian Merchant. He's a contributing writer for Wired. We'll post a link to his story about email tracking on our website at WOSU.org. Dan in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Dan.
Hi. My question is, what about these companies that are giving you or this, quote, free software? Are they also gathering up this information and selling it to somebody else? And is that how they make their money?
Is this a commodity? Brian Merchant?
Well, yeah. I mean, there's all kinds of free software that's floating around now. But if they're offering it for free, you can pretty much guarantee that without exception, that they are going to be able to harvest the data from how you use that and how, you know, when, where, and how. That's the benefit that they're going to be getting out of making it free, is turning it over, getting a huge data profile, basically, of how you use it.
So even if you're just using it because you're a curious type of person, the service that's offering it for free is harvesting it, all this data.
Yeah.
Yeah,
okay. Absolutely. I didn't quite, I don't think this made it into the article, but, you know, Mr. Cerussi, Florian Cerussi, who owns OMC, the company that is trying to fight some of this stuff, he made the point that he sees all the time, he'll get an email from a lawyer or someone from an HR department where they'll have a tracker installed. And they will have emailed somebody, you know, this confidential email that says below, you probably know, and that signature says this email is only intended for the
receiver, right?
Please, right? This is highly confidential. But then they've got a tracker installed. Every single email that you send with a tracker installed goes to Streak's server or whichever tracker you're using. So by using this email tracker, you're basically sending a copy of every single email that you send to this third-party company. I mean, if you check the terms and services, you can see that they'll say they're doing that. But it's, again, it takes you 20 seconds to install this thing, and you might not know that you're doing so. So, yes, absolutely. If you're using one of these free trackers, you're also sending a copy of any email you send to the company.
And is that a breach of whatever contract? I mean, when it says at the bottom that this is intended for only the person to whom it's addressed, is that a breach of that?
I mean, it very well may be. I mean, Cerussi told me, he's like, I just can't believe that, you know, that here this is confidential, but we're just basically handing it over to this third-party company's server, and now they just have a copy of it to do it with it what they will.
How is email tracking related to spam?
Spam is one of those sort of areas that benefits greatly from email tracking. I did talk to a spam researcher for this article, and he says that it's just like marketers. Almost every spammer is going to have sophisticated email tracking installed so that they can know, you know, exactly how effective their spam is, and they can, you know, go beyond that if they wanted to. Malicious spammers can sort of bombard you with spam, and if, again, all you have to do is open it. You don't even have to click on anything, but if you open the spam message, then they're getting a lot of data about you. And sometimes one of the researchers that I spoke to warned that if you open enough of them, they can get enough data to basically profile you. And then you're running into situations where they could feasibly know enough about you to, to try some identity theft, or to, you know, even get, you know, through social engineering, get credit card information and the
Could
like.
You give me an example of how it progresses to that point? What they would glean from me just opening an email, not even clicking on anything, that would give them information?
Right. Okay, so the example that he gave me is if they're sending you spam email and they're watching you open it, and you open an email on the bus every day at the same area. So they say, okay, this is when you commute. If you're opening a bunch from an office email, they can figure out where you work, and then they can sort of, it's fairly easy to reverse engineer a lot of workplace emails. A lot of times it's just name dot. You know, organization.
Okay.
And they can get your ISP at home. If they're bombarding you with spam at home, they can get the sort of the information about the devices and the network that you're using at home. And then depending on where they got your email from in the first place, you know, they might have picked it up off of some sports forum or a music fan site, or some, you know, spammers, you know, buy these emails in bulk. So they might have an email of yours to begin with, and they can combine it with all of these different data points and start to build a profile of you. And then it only takes a few steps beyond that in order to instigate some larger data breaches.
Bill in Clintonville, you're on the air. Hi, Bill.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. My question is, how can I as an individual block this email tracking feature?
So that is the best part about this whole thing, is it's easy to block. Once you're aware and you made the decision that you just don't want to bother with any of this, there's pretty much one or two things you can do. One, if you just want to say, I'm going to be super safe, I'm just going to opt out of this whole world, you can just turn off your image opening. There's a setting in most email clients that is just a simple toggle. Do you want it to open images automatically in your email? And you say yes or no. You just turn it off. Now, that also means that if somebody sends you a GIF of some meme going around or a picture of, you know, their kid's birthday in an email, it won't open that email. So it turns off all images, bar none, in your inbox. That's the safest way.
Let me interview that. I don't get images immediately, but I click on it if I want to see the pictures. Is that what you're talking about?
That it depends client to client on, you know, the different settings that you've got. Gmail, for instance, I think you can just bar none, turn it all off. It's not even going to bother with any of them. I'm not sure. Some trackers will probably still be able to we'll still be able to tell if you open the email, even if you don't click on it.
Mm-hmm.
That's just how sophisticated some of them are getting.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd say, you know, turn off open images in your email client, and then don't click any links that are suspicious at all. So those are the two top of the line. The third thing is you can install something like ugly email or senders or a service that if you even just Google, you can take your pick of tracking blockers, because again, all it has to do is cancel out the opening of that image. And some of these services are getting good. They have to kind of keep up. There's this arms race between trackers and track blockers. That's pretty much those are your options.
Well, on that, I don't know, what do I call it? On that positive note, Brian Merchant, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Brian Merchant's contributing writer for Wired. You can read more about email tracking by going to the link on our website at WOSU.org. More Tech Tuesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. For the past couple weeks, contributing editor at Android Central, Russell Holley, has shared his ideas for kids and adults when it comes to gift giving. Today, we're looking at tech gifts for teens. Russell Holley, thanks as always for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
At the top of your list is the virtual reality headset PlayStation VR. Before anyone picks out a brand, what should gift givers know about virtual reality?
Well, the biggest thing to know about virtual reality, especially, you know, most of the headsets, is that you need a little bit of space to do it in. So, you know, if this is something that you're giving a gift to someone and there's an expectation that they're going to be playing it in their bedroom and they don't have a particularly large bedroom, you want to keep that kind of thing in mind, is that this is, you know, particularly PlayStation VR or Oculus Rift or something like that. They're really built for these kind of larger areas so that you can move around a little bit.
And when you say larger area, give us a sense of what you mean by that. Like
the smallest area that you want to mess with is kind of, you know, your arm's width all the way around. You know,
if you
stand still and you can stretch your arms out and twirl in a circle and not hit something, then you've got kind of like the minimum safe space for something like that.
Okay. And then what about the fit of the goggles or whatever you call them?
That's actually one of the reasons that I suggested the PlayStation VR is it's got the best fit for comfort. It fits the most amount of heads without any real kind of work. You can adjust it very quickly for people who have glasses, and it already works if you have a PlayStation 4 console. There's no computer to buy or anything like that. You just need the headset and the camera.
How is it different from other VR options?
The biggest way that this is different is it ties in directly to all of the PlayStation 4 stuff. So if you have friends who are active on PlayStation Network and things like that, it already integrates into all of that so that you can play with friends in a way that is a little more complicated on some of the other platforms.
So you can play with people remotely?
Absolutely.
Oh, man. You and I were talking. I just tried VR for the first time last week. And I'm kind of hooked.
That's like the coolest thing about playing with other people is that you get this kind of, fictional avatar that stands in front of you that you can hear their voice, when they're seeing and as they move around, you see their head movement match and things like that. And there are a bunch of games where, you go and do things together and unlike a traditional game, you're actually turning your head to the left and seeing this other person standing there.
What a blast. So there's things you can do, there's places you can go, and there's games you can play together with other people.
Absolutely, yep. Mm. It's a ton of fun. There's a lot of options.
So is it more affordable? We're talking about teenagers, not tycoons.
This is more affordable if you're looking at, someone who already owns a PlayStation 4. So if you already own a PlayStation 4, the max you're going to spend on a bundle to add PlayStation VR to it is $300. There are bundles available on Amazon and Best Buy, and they come with at least one or two games that can be played. Everything they need if they already have a PlayStation 4, they just plug in and start enjoying VR.
Okay. Another gift on your list that would be good for the teen gamer in your life, the Nintendo Switch. What's the Nintendo Switch? Tell us.
So this is Nintendo's latest console. It was designed to compete directly with the Xbox and the PlayStation this year. And its big feature is that, it connects to your television when you want it to. And when you don't, you can actually pull it out of this dock and take it with you like a handheld console and still have all of the games that you would normally have. So this is a fantastic idea. I'm going to say for teens and totally not for the 32-year-old man sitting on the other end of this phone. that you're talking to, but it's just great for being able to take the game with you no matter where you are, and that's a big thing that you can't get with the Xbox or the PlayStation.
Why do you say it's not good for you?
Because I don't ever put it down, and then I fight with my kids over whose turn it is.
Okay, got it. It's a weak-willed 32-year-old man.
I may be guilty of assigning my kids.
We're kind of losing you, Russell. I'm going to do a reset and see if we can get that situated. You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about gifts for the teen, tech gifts for the teen, with my guest, Russell Holley, contributing editor at AndroidCentral.com. If you have a question or comment for Russell, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can check out our Facebook page. Remember, check out the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. Post your question or comment there. Russell, you back?
I am.
Okay, good. So what are some of the most popular game titles?
Oh, this year, some of the most popular game titles are a lot of the ones that have actually been around for a little while. We have, Doom and Super Mario Odyssey and Nier Automata. But I think the Super Mario Odyssey actually just won a whole bunch of awards for being Game of the Year, and it's only available on the Nintendo Switch. But there are other games like Horizon Zero Dawn for PlayStation 4 where they step out of this, shooter aspect and they become more, puzzle-focused or exploration-focused. And they've been really popular this year. It's kind of drifting away from that stereotypical shoot the bad guy game.
Now, when Switch was first released, people were disappointed there weren't enough games. That's fixed now?
There are so many games. Yeah, okay. Just a tremendous amount that have come out recently. And not just, official games from Nintendo, is actually one of the big things about this console, is it opened up to what are called indie games, which are games that a small publisher can very easily release to the Switch. And there are hundreds of those games on the Switch now that are often $5 and $6 that you can play for hours.
Wow. Okay. When you use it in the portable mode, when you pick it up, unplug it and blah, blah, and walk away, how long does that battery last?
Well, so it depends on the game you're playing. If you're playing a really visually intense game like Legend of Zelda, it'll last probably 2-2.5 hours. But if you're playing most of the other games on the console, it'll last between 4 and 5.
And what are we talking about in terms of money?
This is going to be $299 for just the console and the controllers that come with it. You're going to want another game, which is going to run you probably another $20 or $30. And then if you have if this is a gift for multiple maybe kids or teens, then other controllers are going to start at around $60 or $70.
Okay, so it sounds like a family gift kind of a thing.
It can be, yeah.
And depending, the next gift idea on your list is a fitness tractor called Misfit Ray, and I was surprised you were interested in a fitness tractor for a 18.
Well, so, Fitbits are surprisingly popular for just a whole bunch of different people, just because it gives you data and it gives you, kind of information, but they're really not particularly attractive looking. And the more I started talking to, different people who were active, just kind of in their daily lives, one of the things that, came out as a feature was something that didn't look like, a Fitbit that sat on your wrist, didn't look like that kind of, rubbery thing that sat there. And so I went and looked, and the Misfit Ray is the one that fits the bill. It really looks like a piece of jewelry that you wear on your wrist. It has this kind of metal cylinder look to it and a very simple strap, but it doesn't look like a gadget. It looks very much like a piece of jewelry, and it tracks all kinds of different activities, biking, running, swimming. The Misfit app is really incredible for that kind of thing, and they're the whole focus there is to have it not look and feel, like a gadget, basically.
Well, so why is it called Misfit Ray?
Well, Misfit is the name of the company.
Oh, okay.
And they just have bizarre names for all of their stuff. Their first tracker was called the Shine, and then they have the Ray, and they have something else. So there's it's just their thing is to have this kind of silly, simple names, and then Misfit being the name of the company. So it does kind of have an odd name to it.
What are some of its limitations? It looks good. It gathers a lot of data, but any limits?
Well, so there's no screen on it. This is, like I said, the design here is to be very much not like a Fitbit or a smartwatch or something like that. So you're not really able to check, immediately by looking down at your wrist, how many steps you've taken or how far you've gone or something like that. So the goal here is that, you would wear it and just kind of have it exist on your wrist. And then at the end of the day, you would sync it back to your phone and then you'd get that information on your phone. And you can sync it to your phone anytime. But in doing so, you kind of have to stop and open up the app and do that. So that's the only real limitation there, as a result of not being a gadget, is that it doesn't behave like a gadget.
No immediate gratification.
Right.
Hmm. What about the cost?
So these start at $70, and they're available in a couple of different colors. You can get a little more expensive version depending on the kind of material you want it to be made of or the strap that goes on the bracelet if you want something that's a little fancier. But they start, relatively inexpensive compared to a lot of other fitness trackers.
Now, when you talk about what these look like, are we talking for anybody, male or female?
So I think a lot of the options for the Ray have more of a female twist to them, but I actually really like they have a silvery kind of steel look and a black version that would lean a little more towards the masculine, I guess.
Of course, we're talking stereotypes, but yeah.
Right. Yeah. It's obviously stereotypes there, but it's, it's a metal band that sits on your wrist. It really just depends on you, I guess.
Okay. Your pick for a tablet for teens is the Amazon Kindle Paperwhite, and it's been around for a while. Just remind us of what it does in the first place.
So the Paperwhite was Amazon's first version of the Kindle that was flat black and white. It was designed to be very, very lightweight, and it had this special screen that was backlit, where the original Kindles were not. And so the real benefit here was really aimed at my teenager when I was suggesting this, who is very much like her father at that age, helplessly addicted to reading books in bed until 2 o'clock in the morning, without things like an overhead light or anything like that. So these are really just kind of the solution to that. You know, you can store a nearly unlimited number of books on these things, and they are backlit so that you can read in any lighting situation, and it makes them significantly more useful and much better for your eyes.
Paperwhites improved over time, right?
They have definitely improved over time. You know, they've worked really hard. Amazon worked almost absurdly hard to make sure that the screen was this kind of perfect white, like a sheet of paper, and that the lighting didn't, you know, kind of dim in corners or anything like that, which you see in a lot of other e-readers that have backlights, is that, you know, the backlights come from different sources, so they don't look very clean going across.
Mm-hmm. And is it mostly just an ebook reader, or can it be used with other apps?
Well, this is mostly an ebook reader, but like all of the Kindle devices, there is a web browser attached to it, so you can do more. But the refresh rate on it is a little on the sluggish side. It's only built to look at something like the New York Times or something like that. You wouldn't you know, be going to Google to look for YouTube videos or anything.
How's the charging going with that?
The charging is, you know, very much like your phone. You plug it in and you know, as you go to use it, the brighter the screen is, the less the battery will last. But I, you know, on my personal Paperwhite, it is probably once a month that I need to recharge mine.
Oh, okay. How much does it cost?
They start at $199 as their default price, but the cool thing about being Christmas time right now is Amazon has pretty much every day another crazy sale for all of the things that they sell. So if you take a look at Amazon for the Paperwhites and the sale isn't quite what you're looking for, you can probably check the next day and find something better.
Mm. Any limitations or concerns about the Paperwhite?
It lacks some of the parental controls that some of the Kindle Fire tablets have, which could be a concern if you're considering something for younger kids or younger teens. But it's you know, as a general book reader, there's nothing really to worry about.
Is there anything that you this year that's going to take the world by storm at Christmas? I'm not seeing anything anyone's waiting in lines for. I think we've talked about it before that those days might be over anyways.
Well, there was one that caught me by surprise, and I've never been happier that my kids are just old enough to not care about this kind of thing.
Yeah.
The toy this year, they're called Fingerlings.
Yeah.
And they're these little, like, almost like troll dolls that hug your finger. Like they're designed to wrap around your finger so that, like, you put them you put them on your finger, and there's a collection race for them because there's a bunch of different colors and options, and so that was the one thing that I saw people actively waiting in line for or kind of constantly refreshing Amazon for were these Fingerlings, you know, but in specific colors. I saw a bunch of parents who were like hunting down the purple version and things like that.
Okay.
And I just could not have been happier that my kids are just old enough to not care about that.
No kidding. Beanie Babies 2017.
Absolutely. Yep.
Well, Russell Holley, thanks for joining us. As always, appreciate your insights.
Thank you for having me.
That's Russell Holley. He is contributing editor at Android Central. We'll have a link to his posts on our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. That's it for Tech Tuesday today. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.